Welcome back to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb. Right now, our guest is John Wohlstetter, who is an expert on the Middle East and can talk with us about the recent shooting in Paris. And in fact, John Wohlstetter is an author, and he is also a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute. John, you have said in a recent article that essentially last week's shooting in Paris was the West's 3 a.m. wake-up call. That's a very interesting point. How about a comment on that?
Well, essentially, the wake-up call is that either we ditch multiculturalism or kiss freedom goodbye. It's an irony that you have a nighttime comedian, Bill Maher, who is very left-wing for the most part.
Yes.
One may recall that after 9/11, he said that he thought that you shouldn't call the attackers, the 9/11 attackers,
cowards. Mm-hmm.
But he said that, and he said last year in an exchange with Ben Affleck, and he repeated again this year, just this week, he said this is the only religion that kills people who offend it, who offend its votaries. All sorts of stuff is done that's very insulting to Catholics, putting a crucifix in urine, calling it an object of art, and nobody gets shot for doing that. And, of course, Jews are offended all the time, too, and I suppose Buddhists are and everything else, but this religion alone claims the right to curtail the freedoms of everyone else. And this is a fight for those freedoms. And it'll be interesting to see if we can get those who have embraced multiculturalism on the left to reconsider. You know, there's a lot of talk about our values when they were saying, well, we weren't true to our values with harsh interrogations. Well, here, everybody agrees that a core value of our constitutional architecture and civilization is free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are saying, you speak out and we don't like it, we shoot and kill you. And they did. And it is the most open wake-up call since 9/11 as to what we're up against, I think. It can be said there were others, you know, 3/11 in Spain, the train bombings and the train bombings in London and the horrific bombings in Bali that killed so many Australians in 02. But this is a direct assault targeting people who were among the leading satirists in France, and satire has historically been a very powerful weapon in politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, Howard Dean said, quote, I stopped calling these people Muslim terrorists. They're about as Muslim as I am. What are your comments on that?
Well, Howard Dean doesn't seem to understand that no Muslim, whether moderate or radical or otherwise, is going to listen to a non-Muslim and tell him or her what Islam is. It is not for people who are not Muslim to presume to make that kind of judgment. We don't have to. But it's interesting because if a Christian extremist bombs an abortion clinic, nobody says it wasn't done by a Christian. And if a Jewish terrorist commits an act of terrorism, they're called Jewish terrorists. These people are Muslim. That doesn't mean that they're typically Muslim. Obviously, the vast majority are not as radical as this, and many are moderate. But we ought to understand also that you can define, in part, those who are moderate by them not being offended when we call out those who are militant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very confused and foolish statement on Howard Dean's part.
He also said, I think ISIS is a cult, not an Islamic cult. I think it's a cult. Now he said that, but you also have David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, said about 3 or 4 months ago after ISIS was doing some of these beheadings, he said something like, they're not Muslims, they're murderers. And even the president has said some things almost along those same lines.
Yes. Well, again, this is a form of denial. The fact is that nobody would say the same thing about Christians who committed murder or Jews who did. And this is something that's a fear of offending Islam. Of course, in Britain, this is a country where in the northern part of Britain, in a story that just came to light a few months ago, they discovered that in a whole bunch of medium-sized cities in the north of England, that there had been literally over 1,000 rapes, I think 1,416 years in one town up there, that went unreported to the police, or what few were reported, the complainants found themselves in trouble. It was Pakistanis up there who were raping Christian women, and the police were not enforcing the law. So Britain has a very serious problem because it hasn't confronted this situation, and neither have the French, of course, which is why you have all of these so-called no-go zones or areas where literally Sharia law reigns, and not just Sharia law and something that might be what constitutes a religiously recognized marriage, but on things like honor killings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you're absolutely right. I mean, it would make sense allowing Sharia law in terms of washings or things like that, but when you're talking about violating such basic laws as thou shalt do no murder, that certainly is way beyond the line. Now, let me quote a little bit from your blog, and you can comment on these maybe one at a time. In Paris, gendarmes arrived on the scene of the horrific mass murder without guns and had to flee from terrorists armed with AK-47s. And I might add, one of those policemen was down on the sidewalk. You could see him there in one of the videos. He's pleading for his life. They go right up to him, bam, you know, shoot him execution style. Oh, and it turns out that policeman was a Muslim himself.
A devout, that's exactly right, a devout Muslim and a true moderate Muslim, obviously. But you had a situation there where here is a country where the gun control laws are absolutely airtight. They are no private citizen, as a practical matter, is going to be able to get a permit to carry a gun in France or to own one. And yet, the fact is, this stuff could be smuggled in. It's not hard to get AK-47s smuggled around. They're not that expensive. And if they went and got trained, you can bet they also got probably a little bit of support also or instructions on how to obtain them on the black market. So this is an example of how not only these gun control futile, but then they didn't have enough armed police initially to confront these people, even if they had not been armed with automatic weapons, and police generally aren't. Those are SWAT teams or something. If somebody had surprised these people and, you know, they had a pistol or several people, they might have had a chance with only two of them to shoot them if they saw them first.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're talking right now with John Wohlstetter. That is spelled W-O-H-L-S-E-T-T-E-R.
S-T-E-T-T-E-R, Wohlstetter.
Right, okay, and he's a senior fellow at the Seattle-based Discovery Institute and then also the New York-based Herb London Center. Herb London, didn't he used to be the head of Hudson Institute?
Hudson. Yes, he did.
Oh, okay.
I was with Hudson, a trustee of Hudson then.
Terrific.
So I wasn't a senior fellow there, but I was a trustee.
Oh, well, I really appreciate Michael Horowitz. Through the years, I've interviewed him on the subject of the persecution of Christians, which is something he is a specialist on. Now, you've written a book, a couple books actually, but one of the books I think probably still applies to all these things, The Long War Ahead and The Short War Upon Us, which is a book examining issues arising out of the September 11th, 2001 attacks on America. I assume your material can be found at discovery.org or is there another website?
If you just go to Letter from the Capitol, OL, is my one-stop shop.
Okay.
Google it. You Google Letter from the Capitol, and you'll see images of both my books there. My first book did devote a couple of chapters to just this problem, two or three chapters, actually. One chapter was on Islam in the West. And the basic thing that I said there is that Islam is a religion that has not gone through a reformation. And as a result, it coexist very uneasily mm-hmm. with modern life. And until there is some sort of a reformation, which we obviously can't do, mm-hmm. We're still going to have that problem. Now, we had a very significant thing on New Year's Day.
Yes, with the president of Egypt.
That's right. Al-Sisi is a brilliant brilliant leader. I had the privilege with a small group, including Herb London, when the London Center, there were eight of us, we went over there, several journalists as well as several of us from the London Center, and we met with the top leaders of Egypt in April, including al-Sisi. That was 2 months before he became president. We met also with their intelligence chief, their defense minister, and their foreign minister. So we had about 8 hours between the four of them. And they are very much aware of the problems and the lack of understanding in this country. The Muslim Brotherhood is a political movement. It's Islamist. And what it did, this is very important to explain why al-Sisi said what he said on New Year's Day. This is worth going into a little bit. Mm-hmm. The Muslim Brotherhood followed the Nazi model of coming to power. Their party won a legitimate election. It was the first ever legitimate election in Egypt's history. They won it in 2012, having pushed Mubarak out in 2011, and it took a little over a year to get these things going. They had promised not to make Egypt a Sharia state. They got in, and then 5 months later, what they did was they coalesced, they got in a coalition with two Salafist religious parties. Two extremist Islamic parties and this political Islamic movement, the Brotherhood, got together, and they now had enough votes, more than 68% of the parliament, 67%, to change the basic law, which is what they call the constitution over there. And they did so and had a referendum on it. It was a Sharia state. It was not a supervised international referendum. And now Egypt was a Sharia state, and that's when opposition cropped up. And al-Sisi was then called upon, and he said he would only come forward if the people would come out and show that they really wanted it. And 30 million of 90 million Egyptians went out into the streets.
Wow.
Most of them not in Cairo, so a lot of this didn't even get on the Western news. And what you had then was a counter-revolution supported popularly against the clandestine inside coup that had been mounted by the Brotherhood, where they took their elected position and they transformed it into a Sharia state, and Morsi was their Führer, so to speak.
Mm.
And it was this that, supported by the people, with more people out in the streets than maybe were ever out in any revolution ever, a third of the entire country, that they took it back from them, and they outlawed, quite rightly, the Muslim Brotherhood, because they don't play by the rules of democratic parties. And you can't let parties to have a rule of one man, one vote once,
right,
participate in democracy.
By the way, the significance of that 30 million is huge. One third of the country.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is that about a month or two after that, in the summer of 2013, then Muslim Brotherhood types stuck it on the Christians, went on a rampage, scapegoating the Christians. This is all your fault. But even if every single Christian in Egypt was out there, there still would have been a couple, you know, maybe 20 more millions
of
Muslims
the
out there.
Are about 10%.
Right.
Now, what al-Sisi did on New Year's Day was at Al-Azhar, the oldest university in the Middle East, and a place venerated as learning, and it's also where it was the wellspring of al-Qaeda. He went there, and I don't have his quote in front of me, but he basically said, we cannot go out and do this to the rest of the world, setting ourselves up at war with the rest of the world, and we are destroying our own community. I'm paraphrasing, of course, because I just don't have the quote in front of me,
right,
and don't want to try and pull it up. But that's
right,
the gist of what he said.
Sure.
This is the most significant statement, and it's only the second time that there's been a major challenge from the religious quarter. The other came, and it was much more muted, and that was in 2006 when Pope Benedict spoke at Regensburg after the Danish cartoons thing, and he said, we need to have an interfaith dialogue on this stuff. He was not direct in the way that al-Sisi was, and at the time, there was a very toxic reaction, and the Vatican pulled back. I was told by a friend of mine who was a priest and very knowledgeable in the Vatican affairs, they were worried because basically the Christians in these countries were hostages.
Mm.
So this is a very direct challenge, but Al-Sisi was shunned by the Obama administration and even people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, for God's sakes, because they said, well, it was a democratic election. But the fact is that the Muslim Brotherhood followed the model of the Nazis, who were initially the Nazi Party, got the most votes in the 1933 election, combined with two other parties, and created the Nazi state and appointed Hitler Führer. So this is not something we have any interest in supporting and calling democracy.
Wow. And, you know, it's interesting, too, that the remarks of Al-Sisi, the president of Egypt, from January 1, they are such that, in a sense, that could almost be him signing his death warrant if he's not careful. I mean, I would think that there are some, even now, plotting to try and murder him. Not so much because he's the head, but because of that statement.
Al-Sisi already knew he was a marked man back then, and now he's a doubly marked man. Look, Anwar Sadat made that trip to Jerusalem in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that actually because Jimmy Carter had called for a conference in Geneva, which every party, including the PLO, including the Syrians under the father, Assad the senior, the father of the current butcher, and all the radicals were going to be there, and to preempt that conference where Sadat felt that the radicals would take over the conference and the Carter administration would go along with that, he went to Jerusalem, and that laid the foundation for Camp David. But it also cost Sadat his life after a couple of years later, in October 81,
right,
on the anniversary, 8th anniversary, launching the Yom Kippur War.
All right, now let's get back to Paris, and I understand that Turkey, once leaning towards Europe, in fact, there was talk at one point about Turkey maybe even joining the European Union, and yet they defended the Islamists, but that doesn't mean they defended the attack against the cartoon place.
Actually, they did.
They did?
You have to understand what has happened in Turkey.
That's amazing.
This is the thing that did more to change my mind about the hopes for liberal democracy in that part of the world, because frankly, at the time of the Iraq War, I was an optimist on that. The Turks were, in the 80s and 90s, the Turks were run by very pro-Western leaders. Unfortunately, the last one of those was monumentally corrupt. And corruption is one thing that will get a government thrown out almost anywhere where you can. And when Erdogan, the current leader, was elected 11 years ago, about a month before we went into Iraq, now almost 12 years, in the space of a decade, a single wily Islamist, Erdogan, has virtually undone what appeared to be this solid secular state established by Kemal Atatürk in 1923, and he ran it until he died in 1938. But now here you are, just eight decades later, and it is basically not no longer there, and there's no thought now of Turkey going anywhere near the common market. The question is whether they should even be kept in NATO, because they're no longer a reliable ally.
All right, now,
and I don't think they should be. We should make a deal with the Kurds, but this administration wants to keep the Kurds inside Iraq, which I think will fail eventually.
Mm.
But they are wedded to old concepts, and they do not understand what's happening, in my view.
Who's the they?
The
Obama administration?
And yeah. Turkey, which was Exhibit A in Islam and democracy can work just fine, is now Exhibit A in
the opposite.
That it is, if it can't make it in Turkey, where's it going to make it?
Now, here's another point that you make. And by the way, for those who may have just joined us, we're talking with John Wolfstetter. And you can find his works at letterfromthecapital.com, capital spelled O-L. You said in reference to the Paris massacre last week, worst of all is journalistic cowardice exemplified by silence when a Seattle cartoonist, this was a few years ago, was forced into seclusion after calling for an Everybody Draw Muhammad Day.
That's right. And one of the things that makes it so hard for our society is the way we're set up. The police cannot protect or do not protect anyone in that situation because they think if there's too many of them, they don't have the resources to do it. It doesn't even have to be a threat from an Islamist. It happened that a friend of mine about a little over a decade ago found that her car had been vandalized several times in a period of a few months and some threatening notes left. She had no idea who it was. They weren't signed notes. She went to the police and they said, "You want some advice?" Because she asked them, "Move out. Move away." And she relocated to California. They will not protect you. The police position is they have an obligation to protect the community as a whole, but no one individually. Oh. And a lot of the Muslims know this. And so when you get a direct threat like that, the only way you can deal with it is by doing what we did not do back then and at the time of the Danish Islands Post in the controversy and did not do this time, which is everyone should have published every one of those cartoons.
Well, now, let me say this. We don't want to needlessly offend people in their religion. I mean, in other words, on the one hand, the cartoonist would have the right to publish those things, and on the other hand, just trying to show decency. I'm a follower of Jesus. Jesus said, treat others as you would have them treat you. I'm not going to win a Muslim to Christ, which I would like to, if I first offend him by, you know, insulting the prophet or whatever, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but that makes sense as manners. But you have to remember that if you make the touchstone of the length of the ambit of your freedom, the reach of it, what offends others, the people who are the most easily offended are the most radical and extreme out there. And you will have the least freedom of speech when you most need it.
Yeah.
So you can't do this. It's one thing. Look, people have constitutional right to be jerks.
Yeah.
And the thing is, as I said, you know, the artist who did that piss Christ was
right.
A jerk.
Right.
And there are others things like
well,
that.
Well, and by the way, the most
threatened him.
Yeah, no, that's true. And the most offensive part about the whole thing was the fact that was actually funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, which means our government said, we believe this is worthy of art, and they paid the artist, so-called, the urinator, really, $10,000 or whatever it was. So, I mean, but you're right. Nobody took up a gun and, you know, shot the head of the National Endowments for the Arts or the so-called artist, the urinator. Hey, that's a new term I've come up with.
So,
anyway.
What is at stake here is, do we define the ambit of our freedom of speech or do our adversaries?
Ah, that's a good way.
We cannot cede that to our adversaries. We even have to defend jerks.
Right.
Some of their cartoons were funny and some weren't.
Right.
But do you not? Cartoons can say it all sometimes. There was one of the cartoons published right after this horrific massacre was an Australian cartoonist, and it was around on the web, and I posted it. It showed on my Twitter account, it showed a hooded terrorist, obviously an Islamist terrorist.
Oh, yes.
Standing with a gun over the dead body of a cartoonist, and he says, he drew first. And that's a very important form of expression. That captures a great deal just in that one line caption and that one picture. And cartoons have long played a role in American political history. Quite famously, the cartoons of Thomas Nast led to the fall of the Boss Tweed ring. So we cannot, you know, Bill Mayer, of all people, understands this.
No, I agree.
Dean does not.
I agree with you. And, I was on Bill Maher's show, you know, back when it was on ABC TV a few years ago, a few times, actually, four times, in fact. But who's counting? All right, here's another point in your blog. Again, John Wohlstetter, Middle East expert. We're talking about this whole issue of radical Islam, especially in light of the Paris attack just last week. We cannot prevail unless we identify the enemy. Boy, do I agree with that. Militant Islam's challenge is ideological. opposition of religious pluralism and Western freedoms. That is so true. I mean, a Muslim who embodies these values, who agrees with those values, where they'll kill somebody if you insult their religion or something like that, that could be a person who's a convert, who's a Caucasian.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the great Dutch Somali-Dutch dissenter who's now here in the States, and she said, the last part, she said it perfectly, when we try not to offend them and we appease leaders of Muslim organizations, what do we get in return, she writes? Kalashnikovs in the heart of Paris. The more we oblige, the more we self-center, the more we appease, the bolder the enemy gets. It's exactly the point I was making. The people who are going to push the boundaries of what offends them and restrain your speech the most are the most extreme and radical, and those are the people against whom you need your freedom the most.
Hmm. All right, we have about 2 minutes to wrap up. What would you like to say that you haven't said about the Paris attack?
What I would say is that so far the signs are not encouraging that this administration understands what's at stake, or even necessarily that the French do. It's not enough to go out in the street and say, we are all Charlie Hebdo, or nous sommes tous les Parisiens, as I put in my the thing is,
what does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, we are all Parisians now.
Oh, okay.
We are all yeah. But the thing is, we have to do things. We have to publish these things. We have to say these things. We have to defend this, and it may become necessary to take. Well, it will become necessary to take some further steps. One thing all of the societies in the West should do: if we find out someone has gone off to wage jihad, strip them of their citizenship and don't let them come back.
Yeah.
And share that intelligence with your allies and tell them not to let them in either.
Yeah.
They want to go over there and join the jihad. We don't like that, but that's one way to get them out of here.
And then what about this? All these prisoners from Guantanamo Bay that are being let go, and some of them absolutely return to jihad. And then meanwhile, ISIS is managing to recruit a lot of people in the West. I'm sure they're just people who are disaffected losers, basically, but they're going. And they're joining the cause.
They're joining because of what Osama bin Laden said. People prefer a strong horse to a weak horse. If ISIS were losing, they would not be flocking over there to fight with them.
Mm.
People go to join winning. They jump on bandwagons of people that look like winners. They don't go out there to get slaughtered.
Mm.
You wouldn't want to go into the mosque and say, hey, the Americans wiped out half of our force last night. We need recruits. See how many people get up and go. But, hey, we got the Americans on the run last night. They threw 20 airstrikes at us and didn't kill any of us. You'll get a whole bunch of people who will go out the door.
Do you think that there's a fair amount of Muslims in America who are sympathetic to ISIS or sympathetic to those thugs who did the murders in Paris?
Well, we have a few million here. Many of the Arabs here, of course, are not Muslim, and many of the Muslims are not Arab in this country, including about 20% of Muslims, I think, are native-born black Americans. Some of them will sympathize, but in this country we have less of a problem because we've done a much better job of assimilating the Muslim populations. I think that Arab Americans, on the whole, have a higher average income than the country's average. And it may even be true of Muslim Americans, particularly if you talk about those who've come here from other countries rather than those who are native-born. So they are part of society to a much greater degree. Over there, they've been allowed to congregate in these suburbs around the great cities,
yeah,
and run their the French have just left them there and said, okay, you run it. And this is you're reaping the whirlwind now. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't even think the police or the firemen are able to go into those certain conclaves.
They don't?
Are you asking or saying?
No, they don't.
They don't. That's amazing. All right. Again, lettersfromthecapitol.com for more information from our guest, who has been John Wustetter, national security and foreign policy expert, and a senior fellow with the Discovery Institute. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Well, thanks. Great to be with you, Jerry, and great to be with your audience.
All right. Bye-bye now. All the best.
Bye.